Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michel Chassadovsky. This proud program is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization, which comes to you from Montreal, Canada. Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. And today we are welcoming on our program, joining us from North Carolina, distinguished guest, Michael Carmichael, who is an author, historian, and he has a long history of review and analysis of the U.S. political scene. He has worked with five American presidential campaigns for progressive candidates, from Robert Kennedy to Clinton. He has also been closely associated with Dennis Kucinich. He founded in 2003 the Planetary Movement. It's a nonprofit public affairs organization, which is now based in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And he has appeared on public affairs programs for the British Broadcasting Corporation and various other media. He's a frequent contributor to our website at globalresearch.ca. Michael Carmichael, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much for that lovely introduction, Michelle. It's good to hear your voice again and to know that your program is helping to inform American citizens and citizens all around the world. The work of global research is absolutely vital. It is the cutting edge of commentary and analysis, and your own work, of course, is tremendously and deeply appreciated by your readers.
Well, thank you very much. Michael, I think more than anybody else, you can inform us on the new Obama administration, both in terms of hopes as well as in terms of critique. Your analysis has been extremely, I think, incisive in this regard. If I understand correctly, you are supportive of the Obama presidency, but you are also very analytical, and you're looking at the configuration of this administration. Is that a correct assessment?
Well, yes, of course, it is. At this point in history, I mean, we have we're only 1 week into the new administration, and it's already clear that there is a sea change across the board from, you know, the domestic policy agenda and the foreign policy agendas are undergoing massive reorientation. When I say a massive reorientation, the changes are most dramatic, really, in terms of foreign policy. That said, that is only the case because due to the economic and financial meltdown that took place in the last stages of the Bush presidency was already moving in a very decisive manner. And, of course, you're an economist, so you can really help us understand how significant the new direction in the U.S. economy is and how flawed the current trajectory may well be. But in terms of foreign policy, we've seen some very dramatic developments in just the last few days. And not only have we seen the spectacle of the first black American president, which in and of itself is a watershed of history, but we've seen Barack Obama is not the typical American African American. Quite the opposite, in fact. He is a person who is of African American heritage, in that his father was a native of Africa and his mother was an American, rather than being the descendant of African-American slaves.
Michael, we have to go to commercial break. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Global Research NewsHour, an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization. This is Michel Chalsadovsky. Our website, www.globalresearch.ca. Several of the most recent articles of our guest, Michael Carmichael, are on global research and can be consulted. Welcome back, Michael. We were discussing the Obama administration. There have been a number of people who have expressed a different point of view, that in fact they have said that Obama has the support of AIPAC, the pro-Israeli lobby, that he supports the war on terrorism, and also I think there's also been a critique of Obama's economic team, which is headed by people who have who were responsible for the 1999 deregulation of the financial system under the Financial Services Modernization Act and the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. How would you respond to those critiques?
Well, I wouldn't defend all of the Obama administration against all of the charges that are emerging against it. Specifically, the economic arguments, I think, bear a lot of consideration. Let's turn, though, to foreign policy, which is where I've primarily been focused.
Right.
And in terms of, you know, let's start out with the charge that Obama is supporting the war on terror. Well, you know, it's very difficult to sustain that argument today. In his inaugural address, Barack Obama did not mention the word terror. In fact, the entire term and concept of a war on terror has now been relegated to the past precincts of American history. Obama says that it is impossible to wage war on terror because terror is a tactic. It is not a population. It is not an enemy in and of itself. That is such an open-ended concept, it's not valid. And so he is focusing instead on Al-Qaeda. And that is how he justifies what will be a change of strategy in Afghanistan. Now, at first, that strategy was announced last year that there would be a surge of troops into Afghanistan. And that's still the way that it is understood by most people. But in his inaugural address, he changed his rhetoric again to define the objective in Afghanistan is now to forge a lasting peace. In other words, the thrust and the narrative of the Obama administration is strikingly different from the Bush administration. The war on terror is no longer the paradigm of the Obama of the new administration. That has been displaced by a new paradigm.
But I've been doing research on this for quite a number of years, because as you recall, when the Bush administration launched the war in Afghanistan, they essentially said this is retribution for 9/11, and it's Al-Qaeda who is behind the attacks and so on. Now, I don't want to enter into the discussion on 9/11, but that war was justified on something which was very, you know, unsubstantiated, because there was no evidence that Al-Qaeda was involved in the attacks, and moreover, the war on Afghanistan took place within 4 weeks of the 9/11, so that you couldn't reasonably have planned a war in four weeks and so on. So that the question of legitimacy of that war is still, from my point of view, still very important. Was this a legitimate pretext to wage war on a foreign country, you know, thousands of miles away, claiming it had something to do with the 9/11 attacks? Has the Obama administration come to terms with that kind of issue?
Well, I mean, I would say that the rationale for the attack on Afghanistan, for the war on Afghanistan, certainly does stem from 9/11, and it's general perception in the United States. But the fact is that in subsequent public statements, Osama bin Laden has praised the attack on 9/11, and to a certain extent attempted to take credit for it. Now, one of the most interesting things that the Obama administration have done in the first, blitzkrieg of their administration is to reinforce the Freedom of Information Act. And Obama has shifted the Bush policy totally, 180 degrees, when under Bush, secrecy achieved its broadest implementation in American history. And so much of American official documents have been classified, as you well know. In fact, the official report of the 9/11 Commission, when it was finally published, it was published with something like, and you correct me here, Michelle, because I'm sure you're more familiar with this than I am, but around 28 or 29 pages were left blank, which involved the commission's findings about the role of Saudi Arabia in 9/11. Well, on his first day as president, Barack Obama says that we're going to have reinforced the Freedom of Information Act. We are a democratic society, and we need to have transparency as the bedrock of our constitutional democracy. And so we are now going to have a new principle involved, and that will be that if there is ever a question about whether or not information should be released or should not be released, we favor releasing the information in the interest of transparency and constitutional democracy. So you could well be right that there could be a lot of ramifications for the understanding of 9/11 that will be derived from that new policy. And that could well help, reshape policy in across a broad spectrum, in fact, of the United States, its approach to homeland security, its approach to national security, as well as foreign policy.
Well, so I think those are very hopeful comments that you're making. It's understood that one does not modify the course, the historical course of U.S. foreign policy overnight. There's a continuum from the Truman Doctrine to the present, and the role that the United States has played on the geopolitical chessboard, the military operations, and so on. But it's true that what you're suggesting is that ultimately there are some significant changes in emphasis which are taking place. Is that the way?
I think that's a very good way of describing it. Significant changes in emphasis, of course. And in fact, the entire tenor of government is changing, Michelle. Let's just take a look at that other charge, too, that Barack Obama is committed to the so-called, I think you said, AIPAC and the Israel lobby, which are phrases which have become, much more familiar to the average American through the work of John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, who published their study, The Israel Lobby, about the influence of the successive governments of Israel on U.S. policy. And I would say that when Obama spoke to the Israel lobby or to AIPAC in June of last year, he was immediately criticized by a lot of people, and from Yuri Avnery, who is the leader of the Israeli peace movement, to many people in the United States who believe that Israel has exerted a little bit too much influence on U.S. foreign policy. However, since his inauguration, he has reached out. Barack Obama has reached out to the Muslim world like no other president in U.S. history. And in fact, I think it's unique in world history that a leader of a Western nation has reached out so so boldly for friendship and fellowship among the nations of the Muslim world. And this is an extremely bold move for Barack Obama, whose middle name is Hussein. He is actually Barack Hussein Obama, and that is the way he was sworn in before the entire world, watching him place his hand on Abraham Lincoln's Bible. Go ahead.
You mentioned Uri Avnery. We just actually posted his article, which his most recent article, which is called "On the Wrong Side of History," which he actually, I took it from your website, so that was of course very important. How do you view Avnery's assessment?
Well, I mean, as a person who is I'm not Jewish, although I think all families, and I'm very proud that I do have relatives who are Jewish. For intellectuals in Israel, I think that Uri Avnery has to be regarded as the sage of Israel, because he is in favor of a peaceful solution to the problems that are converging on Israel.
Absolutely. I think that Uri Avnery is a very important figure in our understanding of what's going on in Israel and Palestine. We have to go to a short commercial break. We'll be back with our distinguished guest, Michael Carmichael, who's based in North Carolina. Stay with us. This is Michel Chalsudovsky.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. Our website, www.globalresearch.ca. My name is Michel Chalsudovsky, and our guest today, joining us from North Carolina, is Michael Carmichael, distinguished author, historian, and analyst of U.S. foreign policy. Welcome back, Michael. I want to refer our readers to a text which you wrote just shortly, actually, after the inauguration, which is called "Amaze Us, Obama Amaze Us." It's on Michael Carmichael's website of the Planetary Movement. I'll remind our readers, it's Planetary Movement. Is it planetarymovement.com? Is that correct?
No, it's planetarymovement.org.
Planetarymovement.org. Is that correct?
Yes, it is correct,
yeah.
Michel. Thank you very much for that.
If people want to visit the website of Planetary Movement, it's planetarymovement.org. And Michael Carmichael's publications are also posted on our website. And this text, this is a text which went all over America and overseas, "Obama Amaze Us," published on the 20th of January.
Exactly, Michel, and it was actually written before the inauguration, and it is hopefully it encapsulates my attempt there was to encapsulate America's problems at this point in its history. And I think that the problems are really historical and ideological rather than material and physical. And it is that America has lost a lot of freedom over the past 8 or 10 years since the event of 9/11. And when we go back into American history and we look at our founding documents that were compiled by, of course, the founding fathers, and the founding documents also extend to include other important documents in American history, up to and including things like the Emancipation Proclamation, the Gettysburg Address, and the inaugural address of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who promised Americans their four freedoms: freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. And the point of my little essay was to show that Americans have lost those freedoms, and they've lost them very recently, and they've lost them very decisively, and that it is Obama's responsibility, and it's, in fact, an extremely difficult challenge to restore those freedoms. But at this point, I mean, we're only 1 week into his presidency, of course.
Right.
But it, the indications are that he's taking on board the responsibility to restore American freedoms. We've already discussed his reinvigoration of the Freedom of Information Act. And while we do have differences of opinion, I'm sure you and I both have different opinions about Larry Summers, for example, about the way he is handling the economy and which would address the freedom from want and to a certain extent, the freedom from fear. He's also moving ahead very aggressively to restore the freedom of speech. And the one that we really ought to focus on, though, is the freedom of religion, because in post 9/11 America, the freedom of religion has been curtailed for a fairly significant population of Americans. And these are Muslims, because they are treated like criminals and terrorists as a commonplace activity in American society today. People are suspicious of Muslims. They think that they might support acts of terror, when in fact, we've had a Gallup poll in the last few months that was taken on a global basis of all Muslims. It was an enormous sample of 15,000 interviews, face-to-face interviews, that were conducted in 22 different countries. 93% of the global Muslim population do not support al-Qaeda. So 93% of Muslims, that's globally, are opposed to terrorism. I would say that figure could be higher in the United States. So when Barack Hussein Obama was inaugurated, in his inaugural statement, he reached out to the Muslim world saying that he would extend the hand of friendship to those who would unclench their fists. And I hope that we will have time to discuss what he did at the State Department 1 week ago, but let's hold that in abeyance for the moment. The other very symbolic thing he has done is the first television interview granted by a new president after he is inaugurated is a very important gesture. It's a very important prize for the community of broadcasting and publications and in the communications industry, and it usually goes to one of the major American networks like CBS, NBC, or ABC. You might conceivably suspect that it would go to, if it went to a foreign broadcasting organization, it would go to the BBC, the most prestigious broadcasting organization in the world. However, in the case of Obama, the very first interview that he granted in the White House was to the network Al Arabiya, because of their coverage and their profile in the Middle East. So Obama has reached out to the Muslim world in a way that no other president and no other head of state has ever done in the history of the universe.
Michael, we'll have to go to a short commercial break. Stay with us. This is the Global Research News Hour. Our guest, Michael Carmichael, will be back after the break.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, which is an initiative of Global Research. Our website, www.globalresearch.ca. Our guest is Michael Carmichael, who is focusing today on the foreign policy directions of the new Obama administration, as well as the directions in the U.S. Congress. One of your most recent articles is entitled "Towards an Even-Handed Foreign Policy in the U.S. Congress."
Yes.
Can we elaborate a little bit on the on advisors, on the foreign policy advisors, of course, starting with Hillary Clinton, and then we have a number of people who are well known, like Richard Holbrooke, Mitchell, who is also playing a very key, important role. In what sense do you see a new direction in this team of advisors?
Well, I think this is absolutely crucial, and this is really the discussion we should be having, because 1 week ago today, last Thursday, which is really the first or the second day of the Obama presidency after the inaugural festivities and the national prayer breakfast and so forth, when he got down to business. The new president almost always makes his first excursion out of the White House as a matter of course to the Pentagon, because the president is not only the president and the chief legislator in the United States, although he's an executive. He's not a member of the legislative branch of government, but he, of course, writes legislation, and he has the strongest impact of any person in the United States on legislation. In addition to being the chief executive, he is also the commander-in-chief. In other words, he is the head of all of the military apparatus of the United States, and believe me, it is a very vast apparatus. And so, traditionally, the president, we'll say the president from Eisenhower through Bush, would make their first stop outside of the White House, would be the Pentagon. Now, as everyone knows, Obama ran on a platform of change. He wants to change the policies of the Bush administration, and the Bush administration had relied very heavily on military intervention. It relied totally on military interventions and discounted diplomacy. So, in order to reverse that polarity from the outset, President Obama went to the State Department, where he officiated at the installation of the new Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, who was his political opponent over a very long and arduous campaign that was extremely well reported. And there, she made a very interesting statement. She made a statement saying that America is changing its policy vis-a-vis the Middle East, and that we are appointing a new envoy to the region in order to seek peace between the Arabs and the Israelis. And this is, of course, Mr. George Mitchell, who's very well known to most of to those of us in the academic community, and especially to me, because I lived in Oxford, England for 22 years. And I was there when George Mitchell helped negotiate the peace between Britain and the factions in Northern Ireland, which had, of course, led to a period of terrorism, which literally extended from World War I until the signing of the Good Friday Agreement in 1997. So Mitchell has a very solid reputation as an effective negotiator in situations involving chronic conflicts. And the first act of business of the State Department in the Obama administration has been to launch a new initiative based on a change in policy to put diplomacy at the head of American foreign policy. And if you go back and read the statements uttered by Hillary Clinton and George Mitchell and Barack Obama, you can see that there is a fresh, new direction in American foreign policy unfolding today, even as we speak, with Mitchell arriving in the Middle East yesterday. And I think he's going to be in Tel Aviv perhaps as early as today. In addition to these developments, America has been at loggerheads with the nation of Iran over its nuclear program and over numerous other issues. The history between America and Iran goes back to 1856, when Persia established its first embassy in Washington, D.C. and it extends through a period of time when America provided the treasurer's general for numerous governments of Iran prior to World War I, leading up to Arthur Pope's career, and then, of course, the installation of the Pahlavi dynasty by the British in the 1920s. There's a very long history there, but from reports in the press today, we learn that at the State Department, there is a letter being written that will help heal the rift between the United States and Iran. And of course, this is being done at the instigation of President Obama. There are extensive reports about this being published right now as we speak. And it's clear that Obama is taking the lead on this policy, this new policy direction towards Iran.
But just one question.
Go ahead.
How does this new policy towards Iran affect U.S. foreign policy towards Israel? Because in effect, there have been reports, quite recent reports, that Israel is preparing. They made the announcement early in January that they're preparing on the possibility of a conflict with Iran, and they're boosting up their air defense system with U.S. support. So that I agree that the rhetorical stance seems to point in a new direction, which is promising. But if you look at what's happening on the ground, particularly the fact that there were some very large shipments of weaponry, which in fact are slated to arrive late January in Israel from the United States, not for the Gaza conflict, but for some future war. How does all that tally? I mean,
these are very good questions, and I think that it's very important that you raise this issue. Of course, we've been concerned over the last several years by a constant stream of reports from Seymour Hersh and other sources, and by the way, which are frequent, and some of the best analysis really is on your website, Michelle, globalresearch.ca. It has been clear that the Bush administration was, in fact, planning an attack on Iran. The Persian Gulf was the location of a vast American armada. Everyone has been very concerned about broadening the war in the Middle East. And in fact, when polls were first taken on this issue in 2006 and 2007, Americans finally woke up to the fact that they really didn't want to broaden the war in the Middle East. Now, I know that there has been a shipment of arms based on the report we read in Global Research going to Israel. It was delayed, I think. There was some legal action launched, possibly by Amnesty International, and the ship was delayed in Greek waters.
Absolutely, yes.
But I think it
doesn't alter the fact that those shipments will be made. If they're not made by a Greek ship, they'll be shipped otherwise.
Well, you see, let's figure out where these shipments came from. These shipments emanated from the Bush administration, and it's, of course, the neoconservative foreign policy that we've all been living under the boot of for the last 8 years is now crumbling. And what impact Obama is going to be able to have on the commitments of the Bush administration is yet to be determined, because most of these military agreements will have been conducted in secrecy. So this is another reason that that Obama's policy of transparency is so crucial. Not only will we be able to gaze back at 9/11 and take a closer look at that, but we will also be able to take a closer look at the evolution of these commitments by what was really a rogue presidency under George Bush and Dick Cheney to do very reckless and irresponsible things like overburden Israel with far too many weapons.
I have just one sort of key question there. Would you suggest that Obama should then change his defense secretary? Because ultimately, there's continuity from the Bush administration to the Obama administration in that he doesn't actually tackle the power structure of the Pentagon.
Well, you know, Robert Gates, the history of Robert Gates is very interesting. I don't think we want to go into that, although...
Okay, yes, no, I...
He's a very interesting character. But let's not forget that he was installed after Donald Rumsfeld was sacked by Bush, very unceremoniously, by the way. The Wednesday after the Tuesday election in 2006, Bush marched Rumsfeld in front of TV cameras to say that he was resigning, because even Bush is a totally political animal. He has virtually no education, as you're well aware. He's never read the Constitution, doesn't understand his history, didn't even understand the oath of office of the presidency that he took on two separate occasions, but he realized that he had to do something to change, so he removed Donald Rumsfeld, and he turned to his father for advice. His father, one of his father's most reliable factotums was Robert Gates, who had been warehoused at a university in their home state of Texas, and he was called back into public service, and he's taken over the helm of the Pentagon. At the same time, Gates was then serving on the special commission with Lee Hamilton and James Baker that produced the document that recommended the timed withdrawal from Iraq. And of course, Bush rejected that proposal, and he surged the troops instead. But he did appoint Robert Gates, who brought a fresh direction to the Pentagon. Now, should Gates be replaced? When Obama announced that he was going to retain Gates, it was also announced at the same time that this would be for a period of time. I'm sure that he's looking well beyond Gates to others who could become secretaries of defense. Now, Obama's appointments have created a lot of discussion, and one of his most interesting is his national security advisor. Now, you're going to have to help me here.
Yeah, no, the national security advisor is Brzezinski.
No.
No, he Brzezinski is not in the team then. He was proposed, was he not?
No, I don't think so. I think he took himself out of contention. He's a senior advisor.
No, that's correct. I mean, but not officially. But he still has a role to play in the new administration, does he not?
Well, I think he as advisor he's long been an advisor to Barack Obama, and that is one reason that Obama's policies are so strikingly different from George Bush's, because Brzezinski has been the principal critic inside American foreign policy establishment of neoconservatism and of the war in Iraq. The current national security advisor is James L. Jones, a military man who is from the Marine Corps and a general. And General Jones has a very interesting history in that he has a great deal of experience in the Middle East, and amongst that experience, he has a good deal of experience in the Arab-Israeli conflict. He was there, and he has made a striking recommendation. He has recommended that in order to maintain peace in the occupied territories, that NATO should provide a peacekeeping force. So this is a very bold and insightful recommendation coming from a top-ranking American national security advisor. And this is the kind of advice, this is the kind of, you know, really rational and realistic advice that President Obama has been getting. So,
right.
Again, this represents a total sea change, a total break from the Bush administration policies.
How do you view the, well, returning on the issue of Brzezinski, who may be playing a role behind the scenes, although not officially in the advisory team, how do you view his influence? Of course, he was also national security advisor to the Carter administration.
He was. Well, now, Brzezinski has a lot of critics. But when I read his most recent work, let's say his most recent work, say his work criticizing neoconservatism, I have to say that he's certainly the most articulate critic of the entire neoconservative paradigm. And if there is any one intellectual who has done more than anyone else to call attention to flaws in neoconservative doctrine, it would probably have to be Zbigniew Brzezinski. For instance, during the transition period, after Obama won the election and before he took the oath of office, Brzezinski and another highly respected American foreign policy advisor, national security advisor, I should say, is General Brent Scowcroft.
Of course, yes.
The two of them published a memo to Obama. I think it was published in the Wall Street Journal, or it may have been the Washington Post. I think it was actually the Washington Post, in which they recommended very strongly to the president-elect at that time that he elevate the priority of seeking peace in the Middle East by becoming directly engaged with the Arab-Israeli conflict. So Brzezinski has had a tremendous impact. I would say that you are absolutely right, Michelle, that if there is any one intellectual godfather for the Obama administration's foreign policy,
that is Brzezinski. We'll have to go to a commercial break. This is the Global Research News Hour. Stay with us. Our guest is Michael Carmichael. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. This is Michel Chassadovsky from Montreal, Canada. That's where our research center is based, Center for Research on Globalization. This is an initiative of the center. Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. Our guest is Michael Carmichael, who is the founder and director of the Planetary Movement. The website of Planetary Movement is planetarymovement.org, where you will be able to consult Michael Carmichael's publications as well as background information on U.S. foreign policy. Welcome back to the program, Michael. We have just a few more minutes before the end of the program. So how can we conclude?
Well, can we conclude?
It may be too early to conclude.
Well, exactly. I think you're exactly right. We're really only in the very first stages of a new presidency, but it's already, major course changes in domestic and foreign policy are already quite visible. And so the critics who say that there has been no change, that Obama would not bring any change, unfortunately for them, the facts of history are now, unchangeable. There is definitely a new course taking shape. Now, what we ought to look at is maybe some problems. And the major problem area that I have been able to identify in this first 7 days of his presidency is in Afghanistan. And I think we touched on this earlier, but we haven't really examined what's taken place there. And that is that there have been, unfortunately, some civilian deaths by American drones, missiles that were sent to targets in Pakistan from Afghanistan.
Exactly.
And these have produced understandable outrage from the local communities. Now, this might seem like a small problem. I think we're talking about a total of about of three civilians in one case and maybe as many as 10 civilians in another. I'm not really certain on the figures yet. They seem minute and microscopic today. However, these have taken place on Obama's watch. Yes, and it's possible to argue that this is actually sort of a legacy of the Bush administration. But, of course, Obama is on the record as having stated that he wants to focus on Afghanistan and that he would not hesitate to order a missile attack on a Pakistani target should
I think that's a great mistake, is it not? Because, it's a violation of Pakistani sovereignty, and there's been a lot of resentment in Pakistan on these military operations which are conducted against Pakistan.
I agree with you. I think that the Afghanistan and Pakistan theater has not been appraised correctly by the United States military. And I think that we will see that this could be a very, it could grow to a very sizable problem for Obama, very much as the problem of Vietnam seemed small when Lyndon Johnson took over the helm after the assassination of JFK. But it became a problem which absolutely swamped his presidency. Even though, historically, LBJ is regarded as the president of who presided over the catastrophe of Vietnam. Well, in fact, he had one of the boldest and most innovative domestic programs.
Michael, we are going towards the end of the program. This is our guest, Michael Carmichael. This is the Global Research News Hour. Join us tomorrow with Stephen Lenman at the same time, 10 Central Time.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you so much.